the book of Numbers. Exodus seems to, it's very hard to say anything clear on this, but Exodus, when did they begin writing the story of Exodus, writing it? I don't know, but it could have been as early as the late 8th century. And the stories that we've heard and the Ten Commandments, and that's, there's a long tradition, oral tradition going into that. And it wasn't written in one go. It's written and rewritten and rethought and reimagined. And so the final book of Exodus, as we now have it, and that's part of the problem about writing, it kind of locks something in. Oral tradition keeps alive things. But anyhow, they did that. When the final edition was done, I wouldn't know, but it was probably after the exile, probably, let's guess, 500 BC. The book of Numbers takes the Israelites from Mount Sinai into the Promised Land. So it's the rest of the journey. And some of it would be very ancient. Some of it is doubling up, like they'll have another story of the manna and another, they'll double up their stories. Another version, let's say. A lot of it, however, is, it's after the exile, I'd be almost certain of that. It's composed after the exile. Why? Because the rituals had changed. Now we've only got one temple in Jerusalem, and the temple is not the same as the first temple, which was really the chapel for the king, up there on the where the king's thing. The temple after the return from exile is really much more social, much more available to the people. It's not the, because there's no king. So it's not the king's chapel, it's our. So there's differences like that. The ceremonies changed, as ceremonies tend to do, update. So the book of Numbers reads back into Moses and that first generation of Israelites. It reads back the renewed rituals and the renewed priesthood and the renewed laws that had developed over the, and it puts them back into there. In other words, it's not saying they happened then. It's saying we must read this. It all comes from the inspiration of our forefathers. So there's a lot of that in it as well. Let's just look at some little bits out of the book of Numbers. One of the key themes is Yahweh's fidelity during the wilderness period. Amos chapter 2 verse 10, Amos, the earliest of the prophets that we have writings from. Whether they wrote any or their disciples wrote it is an open question, but at least there's a written book called the Prophecies of Amos. And we're talking about the late 8th century, 740 BC. And Amos says, as God say, I brought you up out of the land of Egypt. I led you 40 years in the wilderness. So he's picking up in the late 700s BC, the ancient tradition that everybody knew and was handed on. Jeremiah 31, 2-3 reads, thus says Yahweh, the people who survived the sword found grace in the wilderness. When Israel sought for rest, Yahweh appeared to him from far away. I've loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore, I have continued my faithfulness to you. So Jeremiah, a century and a half after Amos, is, it's automatic to him. He's reminding his people, his listeners, let's say, his audience, and once it's in writing, the readers, few read, but so he's reminding them of this lovely tradition that they all knew about, the origins of their beautiful nation. Deuteronomy 32, 10-14 reads, Yahweh sustained Jacob, and by Jacob they mean he's the father of the 12 tribes, eh? He's called Israel as well, so that's why Jacob is mentioned. And this possibly comes from the northern kingdom, where Jacob was the hero, whereas Abraham was the hero of the Judahites. and they all get linked up eventually. Yahweh sustained Jacob in a desert land, in a howling wilderness waste. He shielded him, cared for him, guarded him as the apple of his eye. As an eagle stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, as it spreads its wings and takes them up and bears them aloft on its pinions, Yahweh alone guided him. No foreign god was with him. He set him atop the heights of the land and fed him with the produce of the field. He nursed him with honey from the crags, oil from flinty rock, curds from the herd and milk from the flock, with fat of lambs and rams, Bashan bulls and goats, together with the choicest wheat, you drank fine wine from the blood of the grape. Hosea, chapter 2, verse 14 to 15, the second oldest, earliest of the written prophets. This is how he looked back on the wilderness journey. God is saying, I will now allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. There she shall respond as in the days of her youth, as at a time when she came out of the land of Egypt. Hosea is living through the siege of Samaria, and there a lot of the northern, a lot of the Galileans, a lot of the people from the hill country of Joseph, and they'd been carted off into exile into Assyria. The Assyrians had brought in fortresses, military centres, and they intermarried with them, etc. So the north was close to collapse, and when Samaria, the town, collapses, it has collapsed. And there's refugees pouring when they can down to Jerusalem. And we know from historical archaeology that Jerusalem grew about two-thirds of what it was, more than what it was before. It had to go right over to the Western Hill because of these people coming in from the north, which of course is what you'd do. And they brought in with them their books, their writings, whatever primitive as they might have been, their laws, their practices, and they interacted with the Judahites, the people from Judah, and so you get then Hezekiah thinking, well, we should get our story written too, and all of that going on. And here's Hosea telling the people that he's reaching in the north, dreadful times you're going through. Look, our ancestors went through dreadful times too, but God loved them in the wilderness. So your hard times can be times of really special love. We're asked to believe that. If you're anything like me, you'd like to believe it. But I don't want any hard times, thanks. I've had enough and I'm tired of it. But when you have them, you've got to make an act of faith that God's loving you in the middle of it. And by the end of it, when you get out of it, you say, yeah, it was. Do you know what I'm talking about? We've all done that. Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 2 to 3. Thus says Yahweh, I remember the devotion of your youth. So that these are all looking back to the time in the wilderness as a very special time. Maybe married couples, many do, when they look back to their first year of marriage, when they had a shed, they didn't have a car, and they didn't have this and they didn't have that, and they had twins for their first babies, and they were as broke as they could be, and they slept on a mattress because they couldn't afford a bed, and you know it's all going on. And they might look back when they're 40 years ordained and think, they were our happiest years because they were poor and had to pull together. And that's what's happening here. Our best years were the years when we were simple. Would become too cluttered. Religious have anyhow. Too many blooming possessions. And when I was a novice at Douglas Park, where I'm now in the novice master's quarters, and got the whole building to myself because we haven't got any novices. Most of you women say it wouldn't work. And you two are already committed, which is great. But we're in a little, God, the room was nothing. You had a bed, and then the width of a bed, and the thing there that had a desk. So you, when you get out of bed, you had to wash it and sprain yourself on the thing, and that was what we had. And no hot water. It can be cold up there. So you have to get up and have your shower. But I'm not saying they were my happiest years. That's the difference. Thus says Yahweh, I remember the devotion of your youth, your love as a bride, how you followed me in the wilderness, in a land not sown. Israel was holy to Yahweh, the first fruits of the harvest. This is all beautiful stuff. But when you read the book of Exodus and the book of Numbers, they're always grumbling and murmuring and wanting to go back to Egypt. So like life, they're both true. And they're looking at different aspects depending on what lesson they want to teach the people. So you don't just say Exodus is right and Jeremiah got it wrong. That'd be a bit silly. But they're all struggling with the complexity of life, which we've all got to struggle with. Numbers chapter 6, the first chapters are who begat somebody, and goes on and on and on, and they're trying to trace their priestly groups back to Aaron and so on. Well, this, you know this one, because we sometimes say it at Mass. Numbers 6, 22 to 27 is the priestly blessing. Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, thus you shall bless the Israelites. You shall say to them, Yahweh bless you and keep you. Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you shalom, peace. So they shall put my name on the Israelites and I will bless them. New Testament, Luke. That's the blessing that Zechariah was supposed to give when he came out of the temple, where the angel of Yahweh had told him, you know, you're going to have the precursor, John. And he was struck dumb, you know that. The first scene in that prelude. It's not history now, it's bigger than that, it's theology. And when he comes out, he can't give the blessing because he's dumb. Luke's making a very important point. Right at the end of the Gospel, the very last scene of the Gospel is the Ascension. And it says, Jesus blessed them. The only blessing, Zechariah is the last of the priests, if you could say it, of the Old Testament. It's finished now. It's done its job. It's brought us to this point. The only one who can now give the blessing is the Messiah. And the Messiah gives them a blessing, and it doesn't mean he gave them a sign of the cross over their foreheads. It means Jesus said to them, this is his last words, Yahweh bless you, keep you. Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you, Peter, Andrew, James, John, etc. Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And then Jesus went into the cloud. It doesn't mean he went up vertically into a cumulus cloud. It means Luke way of saying, where is this Jesus who died and is not with us physically anymore? He's with us, but not the way he was. Where is he? And it's his way of saying he's with God. He's in the mystery of the cloud. The God. Numbers 9:15. On the day the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the covenant. And from evening until morning it was over the tabernacle, having the appearance of fire. It was always so. The cloud covered it by day and the appearance of fire by night. Whenever the cloud lifted from over the tent, then the Israelites would set out. You should know where he pinched that from. The last words of the book of Exodus, which is already there. So he's linking it back there. And in the place where the cloud settled, there the Israelites would camp. So the authors of Numbers, are linking up now with the Exodus story so that they can move on. And they do move on now. Numbers 12:3-8 is a lovely passage too. The man Moses was very humble, more so than anyone else on the face of the earth. This is how they imagined him. Yahweh came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the entrance of the tent and called Aaron, that's Moses' brother, as they put it, and Miriam, who's his sister, Mary, is the English of Miriam. Hear my words. When there are prophets among you, I, Yahweh, make myself known to them in visions. I speak to them in dreams. Not so with my servant Moses. He is entrusted with all my house. With him I speak mouth to mouth, clearly, not in riddles. He beholds, he can't say he beholds Yahweh, he beholds the form of Yahweh. So you can't get closer to God than Moses. And he's unique among the prophets, according to their tradition, of course. So all the best things they can say about the prophets, they say about Moses. Numbers 15:37. Yahweh said to Moses, speak to the Israelites, tell them to make fringes on the corners of their garment. Those tassels, you know. The Pharisees wanted to have longer tassels. The priests want to wear skirts on the altar. That's interesting. Anyhow, they had fringes on the corners of the garments throughout their generations, and to put a blue cord on the fringe of each corner. Blue, apparently blue was really, really expensive. They had to get, I don't know, some kind of shell to make blue in those days. So blue, it was right through the Middle Ages, I think. Blue was the most expensive stuff they could get to put in a painting. So blue means they're part of a priestly people. That's the imagery. You have the fringe so that when you see it, you remember all the commandments of Yahweh and do them and not follow the lust of your own heart and your own eyes. So you shall remember and do all my commandments and you shall be holy to your God. I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am Yahweh your God. So it's still today, people wear a cross, or they wear a medal, or they have a scapula. You know, like these are, we need these physical things to keep reminding us. When I was a boy at home, of course we had religious pictures all around the place. A big picture of the Sacred Heart in the main room, the lounge room, and we only had two bedrooms, mum and dad in one and the two girls in the other. Guess where the six boys were? You'd have to guess because there's no room for them. But we managed to get to bed at night somewhere on the verandas and around. Okay, so that's all very different. But I can remember even little children are really so sensitive. We've got to give it all to them. And when you go into a home today with no crucifixes and no pictures, it's very silly. Like it's depriving the young imaginations. Because I know we had, between our, I'm getting a bit personal in here, but it's all right, between our dining room, let's call it the dining room, where the table was, where we had something to eat, and then you walked out there, and that was the hallway, and the bedrooms were there, and the lounge rooms over here, and on the, there was a picture, a kind of purple colour is my memory of it, and it was Jesus weeping over Jerusalem. I don't know who the author was. I don't think I've seen any since, but it must be somewhere. I'd love to get it. So that was that picture. I can remember as a little kid, no one was telling me to, but I can remember as a little kid gazing at it for a long time. So what's going on in my soul as a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old? I can't remember. My memory doesn't hold it, but my body does, and I can remember standing there. So people know this. Some cultures know it better than us. I'm down the back of Kippax Church getting festive up, ready to go and say Mass. And some cultures come in And oh, they're all over the place. They're kissing the statues and they're putting their fingers and they're touching Jesus and they're touching Mary and they're hanging rosary beads around her neck. I have nothing but joy. I don't do any of those things, but I think, isn't it wonderful? This is how they were brought up, and they're doing things that their body is involved in. Well, that's what these people are doing here. Tassels, you know, you see the Orthodox Jews with these, their hair, and they may have tassels, and they're good things. Not too many tassels around here, but... Okay, Numbers chapter 21, verse 6 to 9. Yahweh sent poisonous serpents among the people. Brackets. Please, God doesn't send poisonous serpents. They just happen to be there. Is that all right? God doesn't have to run everything. Mouse plagues or... Yahweh sent poisonous, but that happened, so Yahweh must have done it. That's their assumption. It doesn't add up. Has to be dismissed as a false assumption, but that's what they've got. If Jerusalem loses the battle, they don't think we lost it because they had a better army and better ammunition and better. They think, well, God must have wanted us to lose, so he must be punishing us for what we did 100 years ago or something. It's dangerous theology, but that was their theology. Yahweh sent poisonous serpents among the people and they bit the people so that many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, we've sinned. See the mentality? By speaking against Yahweh and against you, they had to find something wrong because God is a just God and he wouldn't kill all these people unless they'd done something wrong. To ask Yahweh to take the serpents from us. So Moses prayed for the people and Yahweh said, look, make a poisonous serpent, set it on a pole, and everyone who's bitten shall look at it and live. So Moses made a serpent of bronze, put it on a pole, and whenever a serpent bit someone, that person would look at the serpent of bronze and live. It's a form of sympathetic magic, which a lot of people had in their mentality. But can't possibly be a fact. But it's... And there was a bronze serpent. Something must have happened. There was a bronze serpent in the Ark of the Covenant. And we don't know what happened to it at the time of the collapse of Jerusalem. It probably just vanished. And no one tried to replace it. So harm caused by serpents is counteracted by a serpent that is a divine vehicle for healing. And that's in the mentality of a lot of people. Numbers 27:17, Moses asks Yahweh to appoint someone, quote, who will go out before them and come in before them, who will lead them out and bring them in, so that the congregation of Yahweh may not be like sheep without a shepherd. You heard that before? Jesus looked at the crowd and we're like sheep without a shepherd. We need shepherds. There's spring festivals, which I've gone beyond there, like the autumn festivals talked about that were the practice at the time. The new moon, the seventh month, the offering on the Day of Atonement, offerings on the autumn pilgrimage festival, seventh day of the booths. Because when they went to Jerusalem, this was in between harvests. They collected the harvest and they weren't ready to plough now, so it was their first break the farmers got in the year. So obviously that's a break of a couple of weeks might be. So then they could all then go to the temple in Jerusalem, because they could leave their farm for a while, just lying fallow for a bit. And then when they got to Jerusalem, there's no room for them, so all the surrounding hills were covered with tents. So it's called the Feast of Booths, or tents, tabernacles, probably for that reason.